Kia ora, I'm Graham. Welcome to episode 13 of The Good Oil. Conversations with, well, in this case, an honorary New Zealand painter that happens to hold an Australian passport, Jude Ray. I've been thinking about this as the Farlap or Pavlova episode, as by Jude's own admission, Aotearoa can lay claim, if not to her, then certainly to having a significant formative influence in her practice. I also have to admit a strong personal bias up front. A chance encounter with a painting of Jude's, The Extraordinary Clarambeau's Dream, one rainy Sunday afternoon in the Christchurch Art Gallery, almost single-handedly opened the door to a fascination with paintings and painters, and therefore this podcast. But none of that bias, of course, reduces one iota what a talented and deep-thinking painter Jude is. Jude has a Bachelor of Arts in Fine Arts from the University of Sydney, a Graduate Diploma in Professional Art Studies from the University of New South Wales, and a Master of Arts in Painting from the University of Canterbury. Her work is held in numerous New Zealand and international public and private collections, including the Fletcher Collection, the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waifitu, the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, and Te Papa. She is represented in New Zealand by Two Rooms Gallery in Auckland. There are images of the works we talk about on the Good Oil Jude Ray Instagram post for your reference. In this episode, you'll hear Jude speak about her formative and influential time spent in Christchurch, how doubt in her painting is a baseline state for her, her exploration of the complexities of vision mixed with our other senses and trying to capture that in her work, and the unforgettable experience of driving through a Colin McCann landscape for the first time. We started by talking about her time as a child in her father's painting studio and her childhood drawings.
My mother told me that when I was very little, I spent a lot of time sitting on the floor just watching him paint, which I don't remember. But then when I got too big and probably too mobile, I wasn't really tolerated in there while Dad was working. So I think that they're blurred and blended in my memory. But the other thing that I have in my mind is the little drawings that my mother saved over the years. She actually saved a lot of my father's drawings from the rubbish bin, and amongst them were drawings that I had made of my newborn sister. So I would have been about four, and there, as many kids' drawings are, they're just like, oh, I wish I could draw like that now. You know, they're just so fresh. And the Picasso quotation comes to mind. I spent 65 years learning how to draw like a three-year-old, a five-year-old. And there's a particular drawing of a nude, which is probably from a period a little later than that, but it's not the sort of drawing you would see a kid do. A reclining nude, which could have been my mother posing for Dad. But, you know, I looked at it and thought, that is so weird. You know, usually kids that age are drawing families and sun and, you know, house and bus and stuff like that, but I drew a nude. So, those early memories are the ones that I really have of my own memory are things very close to the ground. I seem to be just very interested in plants and rocks. And we had a very large block.
Well, it's all about perspective at that point, I suppose.
Yes, I guess I was quite close to the ground. Other things like my father worked at the Australian Museum. And I can remember the children's parties that they threw for the kids, the families of the employees. And we used to play chasing through the spirit room. Like, how did they allow that? And so I can remember these bottles with specimens in them. And and the museum had an important effect on me as well.
So growing up around a father who's a painter, I have this idea that it's not just you know, the visual information or visual experience of painting, but probably quite a textural and smell of paint. So all of those different senses were alert to painting.
Yeah, but very much in the way that I walk back into my studio and suddenly I realise I can smell linseed oil. When you're in it, you don't notice it. So, and particularly for children, it's paint rags. I was sitting amongst the paint rags, and you don't realise that other kids don't have that sort of experience.
Yeah.
So I guess you're right. It's like a multi-dimensional sort of sensorial experience. And it does count for quite a lot in the sense that it's a very early component of your reality, I suppose.
Yeah, soaking into you from a very early age. From a quite early age, also embedded in the arts, attending Julian Ashton, right? So for context for Australia, context for New Zealand listeners, Australia's oldest art school, so I think now 120 years old or something. So attending there, like both with your parents and then yourself, right?
Yes, a colonial vestige of the Slade is what I think of it. And when I was there, it was still at the on the top floor of the Mining Museum, right underneath the Millers Point end of the Harbour Bridge. So, and it was still in the state, it was still in the place and the state in which my mum and dad met each other. My mum was a sometime artist model. It had a sort of dusty grandeur, and when a train went over, all the casts which rattled. and you know, one wasn't allowed into the life room until you'd done a stretch in the plaster room. That sort of very traditional approach to observational drawing and painting. And I was not yet 12, but I think my parents allowed me or sent me there on Saturdays when I first started high school, and they knew that I'd be looked after, and the Ashtons knew that I was a sort of sensitive, studious little nerd.
So it was a special accommodation for a particularly nerdy 12-year-old.
Yeah, it was very sweet of them to do that. And as I got older, I'd go in on Friday night to the life class as well. So Saturday mornings or Saturday all day, actually. It was very unusual. I know it was unusual.
Attending Julian Ashton, did you have any sense of how unique that was or how strange it was?
No.
So you're living in your own world of...
I think it was just like an extension of my father's studio in a way. I think my parents were also sort of anxious about keeping me off the streets. Not that I was that sort of child, but I think very fairly early I you know how teenagers get attracted to things they're not sure they even like.
Yeah.
So I had to come to terms with Sydney surf culture. We lived near the beach, so by the time I was about 17, I realised I just loathed surf culture and escaped as soon as I could back to art school full-time the year after I left high school. But by that stage, I was I had quite an emotionally disturbed late teenage. And it has a lot to do with the fact that my mum was ill for a lot of our young life, and the levels of uncertainty in the house, and the fact that she was asthmatic, but people didn't really know how to deal with asthma back in the 60s and 70s, and we moved to the mountains, Blue Mountains, for a little bit to see if it would help. And
so for you as a teenager, quite unsettling.
Very unsettled. Very, very, quite. I was identified as smart, but I just couldn't, I wasn't coping emotionally.
I guess there's a difference between being smart and having the stability to apply yourself.
Absolutely. No stability at all to speak of.
Did that leave you a little wayward as a teenager then?
No, just frightened. just terrified. I mean, I never got into drugs, for instance, because everything was terrifying enough. didn't need any more excitement or weirdness. It was weird enough. Alcohol was a different story, but I was variously unsettled rather than unhinged and unstable. Mm. But by the time I got to 25, I'd actually wound my way through a fairly mediocre undergraduate degree. Initially, I thought I was going to do sciences and materials conservation because I had been working at the Australian Museum right through from work experience at high school to starting to make technical drawings of various artefacts, which was fascinating. I did all sorts of things. They were very good with work experience for me.
So there's a strong link back to that time spent in a museum with your father,
yes,
rather than to the arts directly.
Actually, I hadn't thought of it like that, but yes, it's true. And I was working in the conservation lab when I was a bit older, not you know, early high school, but maybe from my fifth and sixth year. And the conservation lab was responsible for doing a lot of not just conservation work, but a lot of the work that I was given. I was working on mid-century bark paintings, Aboriginal bark paintings, consolidating them with, I think it was toluene or something like that. So I was literally working on these delicate old barks, which really, I think, had made an impression on me. I became very aware of the material quality.
But you're in your mid-20s with no great aspiration to be a painter at this point.
No, this is before I left school.
Ah.
And so when I left high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I enrolled in a fine art history degree eventually. I thought I was going to be a materials conservator because of the work experience I'd been doing, but I didn't have enough science. I didn't have enough chemistry, and actually I would have been terrible. I would have been too impatient.
That sounds a little hypercritical given the patience that is clearly applied to your practice now.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I, at that stage anyway, but they're my paintings.
Yeah, it's a different application.
Yeah, it is a different application, I think, really. So I eventually sort of fought my way out of my emotional problems by teaching myself to swim, actually, in my mid-20s. A lot of the problems I was suffering were to do with body image and just actually not feeling in my body.
To talk a little bit about establishing your career, it doesn't sound like you, as I say, it doesn't sound like you really had any great aspiration to be a painter as such until at least your mid-20s, late 20s even?
I didn't paint very much when I was at university studying fine arts, but I did absorb a lot of more general... In fact, when I enrolled in university, I wanted to do English literature and language, and because of my mental, emotional state, I managed to lose confidence twice and discontinued. And I didn't have enough guidance to know that I could have gone to see a counsellor. I just discontinued, and it was beyond the time when you could do that and not be penalised, and I did it twice, and I was kicked out of the English department, which was terrible because I was in love with poetry.
Mm.
And so I shifted my focus to fine arts, which I was doing a component of. And that was probably a good thing because I learned a lot more about art history helped in broaden my knowledge, not just of the Renaissance, early Renaissance and Northern Renaissance, which were my primary focus, but also contemporary art and politics.
Well, you've hinted at a bit of a crisis of confidence, and that played out in the, I think, 1980s. You had some doubts about, I'm not sure whether, you know, your own doubts about whether you could apply yourself or contribute something to painting, or whether you had doubts about painting full stop. But what?
Yeah, all
what
that. All that and more.
All that and more. Where did that crisis of confidence come from around whether, I mean, it sounds like for a start, you know, yourself and whether you could be a painter?
I think there are a whole lot of intersections between my own fairly powerful lack of confidence and self-doubt on the one hand, and the general discourse about painting and the death of and all the rest of it. I was very conscious of wanting to understand. I seem to need to approach things, at least primarily, in a fairly sort of cerebral way. But I kind of process it feelingly. I don't know whether that makes any sense. So I was thinking a lot about representational painting in particular, because that was kind of my DNA. And around the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, there was a sort of reaction to the death of painting with the trans-avant-garde and a whole bunch of French and Italians, it seemed, mostly. Jörg Immendorf was also in Sydney at some stage, and I was aware of that because I'd enrolled after my art history degree in a sort of transition year offered by the then City Art Institute, which is now UNSW Art School, to do a sort of postgraduate diploma, which shifted my BA to a BA practice. And I was able to get into that fairly easily because I had all these sort of skills. But at the time, the art school had got rid of life drawing. And it was around the same time, I was there at the same time that artists like Tim Schultz, who now shows the same gallery that I do in Sydney, the commercial, and Wendy Sharp and whole bunch of us lobbied furiously to bring back life drawing.
And they'd got rid of life drawing because, and I know this was happening in the 70s and 80s in New Zealand, they got rid of life drawing because it was steamrolled by abstraction. Everything had to be abstraction.
I think it was just seen as old-fashioned and irrelevant, which I guess, you know, that was the prevailing thought. And
so when you looked at, you know, 1,000 years or at least 500 years of still life painting, let's say, did you look at that as actually more of a limitation than an opportunity? That history.
I wasn't as clear about still life painting then. In fact, I didn't much enjoy still life painting at Ashton's. Although I have my first still life, I still have a little pin on the board canvas of a monochrome still life, which was the first. You had to do a terre verte monochrome, and I still have that, and I have my first when they allowed me to use colour.
When they allowed you to use colour?
Yes, well, you know, the confusion between tone and colour is an old one. And they, you know, just for the purposes of clarification, to separate them out is not such a silly idea. And to use something neutral like terre verte, which is a singularly it's actually not a very strong green, which it gives more of a sense of the tonal value, I suppose. And it's not as powerful as using black, for instance, and ending up with something grey. So, yeah, still life hadn't really grabbed me. But that has a lot to do with the fact that I had not really associated it with the roots of modernism.
Mm.
And I think those pennies all dropped for me in New Zealand. Actually, no. I was kind of nearly there when I arrived in New Zealand. I'd kind of worked through a lot of that stuff. And I mean, also the 80s, I'd been... I was involved in teaching history theory to practice students at the University of New South Wales in the late 80s, because I was one of the few evidently able practitioners who also had a history degree. So I was sort of across it. I looked like I was across it. I wasn't across it. But it did launch me into this exploration of post-structuralist theory, and in the hope that it might help me understand painting.
Well,
it seems risible now, but by the time I got to New Zealand, I'd sorted it out. I can remember I was reading something like Lyotard. I was reading something, and Ross Wolfe, who was then, I think, either already or about to become the head of the Visual Arts Crafts Council at the Australia, Visual Arts Crafts Board at the Australian Council, saw a copy of some post-structuralist thing in the back of my car and said, Jude, if you keep reading that, your brain will turn to concrete. And actually, by the time I got to New Zealand in 1990, I found that I agreed with him. But it didn't stop me reading. I just went back beyond the art world discussion and started to look to people like Maurice Merleau-Ponty's writing on art, which when I discovered it, it changed my life. Mm. You know, his essay on Cézanne's doubt had a huge impression on me.
Well, speaking of doubt, do the doubts still linger, either about representational painting or your own practice?
Doubt is my sort of baseline state. And I think a lot of artists probably operate a little like that. I think also maybe doubt isn't quite the right word, but there always needs to be room for questioning.
Yeah.
And it's not comfortable.
So even though doubt isn't the right word, that still then is a motivator. Either it drives inquiry for you or a want to evolve.
Definitely, yeah. And evolution in my practice is it's there, it changes, but it's quite slow.
So how did you find your way out of that doubt to actually start painting?
Leaving Australia was an important moment. Coming here to New Zealand, I was able to get a bit of distance.
Yeah, because you speak fondly. In fact, saying you speak fondly of New Zealand is an understatement. So first quote of yours I'm going to throw at you. My decade in New Zealand was quite literally the making of me as a painter. I mean, talk about endearing yourself to a nation of art fans. So coming here, what was the difference? What was the difference between arriving in New Zealand and your eyes opening to a practice versus staying in London or staying in Australia?
I think London would have been too big for me. I thought I was going to London because that's where my then husband lived. And we were there for not quite a year. And I didn't like it as much as I thought I was going to. In fact, you know, years passed and I realised that I felt more at home in Paris in a funny sort of way.
Mm.
But when my dear ex-husband Chris decided that he needed to finish his law degree, it was quickest to come back to Christchurch and do that there. And it was very much I felt I could look at Australia across the Tasman. I wasn't looking at Australia in England. I mean, it was too much else big going on. But I felt maybe because it was sufficiently familiar, but perhaps not as familiar as I initially thought, and a different relationship to culture.
So, yes, you thought, or you were probably bringing, or you had the luxury of bringing outside eyes to an existing New Zealand, or probably flourishing New Zealand art scene, I suppose, in the 70s, 80s.
It didn't take long for me to realise that New Zealand sustains a more integrated investment in the arts than Australia does. Australia's got this sort of massive... there are a lot of people in Australia, a lot more people in Australia than in New Zealand, but there seem to be a lot more people interested in art in New Zealand than in Australia. And I was... my memory from back then was... And it's still active to some degree today, that the Australian art world is this sort of blue chip and emerging, and then this sort of area in the middle where you're a mid-career artist and nobody's particularly interested. And the market reflected that to some degree. So it was either affordable art or massively expensive art, and nothing much in between. And in Christchurch, you know, I found that school teachers bought art, and all sorts of ordinary people bought art and had art in their homes. And
that's so different from Australia, really?
I think probably my understanding of it was a little distorted because I hadn't been at that level of thinking about it in Australia. I may be wrong about that. But I do think that there's more a sort of community participation, interest in, I don't know, buying a little painting here than I feel it was back then. That's the difference. So we're talking about, this is the late 80s, early 90s. It's quite a long time ago now.
And presumably driven in New Zealand by a bunch of really important painters that will establish themselves as important painters now, but... McCann, Louise Henderson, Doris Glask, all of these characters had some association with Christchurch. So presumably you were seeing some of that work there and that being an influence as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, indeed. I'll never forget driving from Christchurch to Nelson through the Hunderleys. And there was McCann, 6 days in Canterbury. Oh, it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it now. It was a much more palpable connection for me than, even though I must say years later when I found myself in Melbourne and there was an enormous Nolan show on, I'd always admired certain Nolan paintings, but I'd never seen the breadth for myself, not in reproduction, and it suddenly made a lot more sense. So I after spending time in New Zealand, I went back to Australia and suddenly saw it differently as well.
So Australia differently.
Yeah.
For listener reference, we're talking about Sidney Nolan, for anyone that's not familiar with that extraordinary Australian painter.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So in New Zealand then, those paintings were far more accessible by the sounds. And I mean, by accessible, I mean both you're identifying the landscape that generated them, but also being able to see the work themselves.
Yes, yeah.
That time in Christchurch produced the first body of work you're known for. Mm. So painting those drapery paintings. Mm. So did they feel like a real breakthrough for you, producing that work in Christchurch?
Yeah, I think it's funny, looking back on that work, and even at the time, I had my own agenda, and then there was the way it was processed by the sort of cultural currents of the time.
What was your agenda with those paintings then?
Well, I mean, you know, when you realise that it wasn't that I wasn't invested in the discourse around feminism and the representation of the body,
which was the other agenda of the work, not that, yours.
Well, it was partly that, but because I was reading a lot of feminist theory. In fact, I did a component of feminist studies at Canterbury University at the time. So, yes, it was at the front of my mind. But, you know, artists can do things with multiple, you know, motivations. And the paintings of drapery came very much for me out of this idea of still life painting, because mm-hmm. I'd started working when I was in London on just little still life paintings. That's all I could do. We were living in this sort of big polychrome gothic pile on the edge of the Thames near Putney Station, and I was painting in a bedroom. So I was doing small still lives, and the drapery was very much in my mind connected with emptying out a still life. But also, at the time, there was a lot of that, what do they call it in music? Sampling. So it was a bricolage thing that was associated with post-modernity. And I was, of course, having done the history degree, aware of the Leonardo's studies of drapery and the way that they would make maquettes for the drapes of figures in Renaissance paintings by soaking a piece of cloth in plaster and then draping it over an armature, and there you had your draped figure of the donor for the painting of the Madonna and Child, you know, donor sitting in the, or the Madonna and Child. The drapery was a very large component of those, of that period, and of a lot of the Renaissance
religious paintings. So an important sample for you, like sampling, as you've just said, like music, an important piece of sampling from art history brought into still life.
Yeah, and it was very much part of the discourse at the time, possibly a little earlier than when I was actually manifesting it in my work. I was a little bit perhaps behind that, but it was also about taking a still life painting and taking things away from it, because you know that it's very much a trope of, you know, you get your wine bottle and your piece of fruit and your onion and you have a tea towel, and that, you know, that's sort of straight out of Cezanne, I guess, as well. And beyond that, it was the linen that I was painting on, and there was a whole lot of stuff I realised in retrospect, it was about questions about painting, what to paint, how to paint, and to paint the linen that I was painting on was somehow, I don't know, call it an interim solution. But then I started superimposing, disintegrating text over it, which had a lot to do not with, well, with unreadability, but it was also, you know, the small faith that I'd placed in commentary about art, post-modernity, post-structuralism. It was all starting to break up in my faith in it was breaking, and I loved the idea of fragmenting text, and so I played around with that. But and the paintings were getting bigger. I was working from a rather nice piece of linen that I found in a second-hand shop, directly from the motif. And as I became more ambitious with the size of the paintings, I started working from photographic documents, and that allowed me to go large, but I found it so crushingly boring to paint from a photograph that
because the depth's just not there for you to reference.
It's more than that. There's a sort of a if you use the word depth to describe the complexity of three dimensions and a spatial embodiment. You can call it depth, but that seems inadequate to me.
Yeah.
depth is a way of referring to it.
And a photograph is not going to do it.
And a photograph's not going to do it. But and it breaks my heart to see really young art students just locked in on a photograph. There's nothing wrong with using photographs with painting at all. It's just that if that's all you have to rely on, I treat photographs with a great deal of respect. But I can do so because I know I'm aware of the complexity of the process of painting, not from photographs.
Well, that,
the stereopsis for a start, but you know that's not even the half of it.
Well, that goes to another quote of yours to apply to the drapery paintings, and it's a very succinct quote. You've talked about the felt quality of vision, so that implies the multi-sensory experience, presumably of not just viewing a painting, but of painting one as well. So presumably that was something that was important to explore with those drapery paintings.
Yes, well, it was certainly starting out when I was working from the three dimensions, and the absence of it when I found myself being bored by working at a large scale from photographs. Because the paintings, the painting, for instance, in Christchurch Art Gallery is three large, I think it's 18 by 1200.
This is Chambrelet, I always forget how to pronounce.
Oh, Clérimbault's Dream. Yeah, exactly.
Clérimbault's Dream.
So, you know, I think that was me pushing it to the, I just about had enough. I found and in fact, that was also, I suppose, an embrace of the discourse which was about covering the body, because Clérimbault is a figure from French photographic history who had a fascination with Orientalism and the drapery, the national costumes of the Algerians, and that he made very interesting studies, and I was certainly aware of them and made that reference connection, but it really wasn't where I was heading. I was heading in another direction, which had everything to do with the embodiment principle, the discussion around embodiment, but just from a completely different angle.
Mm.
A completely different angle. So the idea of complicating one's awareness of the way an image comes about became more and more... It's almost, with me, it's almost, I'll keep painting and look back and go, oh, that's what I was on about. You know, that's what was starting to press in on my awareness. But it's strictly retrospective for me. I don't know where I'm going most of the time.
In that sense, you're in a constant state of discovery, even if you don't know what that discovery is?
The common phrase is following one's nose.
Hmm.
I think it's a necessary state of unknowing. And it might look like I know what I'm doing, but when I'm in my studio, I think I need I need my studio. I need it to be quiet, and I need to be in a very open state. And that's where I feel safe to be, in that state. I can remember Robert Hughes very archly talking about Matisse as the painter of the great indoors on the Shop of the... I think it was the Shop of the New. And
which, by the way, a quick aside for listeners, if anyone's not familiar with Robert Hughes, very famous Australian art critic.
So the great... That really took my imagination, because I'm definitely an interior sort of person. I don't mind walking down Ponsonby Road with the rain hitting my face. Or actually, it wasn't Ponsonby Road, it was Great North Road.
Yeah.
But I'm a painter of interiors and still life and portraits, and they're all... It's an interior life I have.
Well, before we talk about a few specific paintings of both still life and interior, I wanted to talk more broadly about what the practice is. Although I say practice, as in painting practice, but I sometimes wonder if really what's going on is that you're conducting scientific research or some science experiment more than you are painting. So do you feel like, if anything, your practice is actually about the practice of painting primarily? It's not about any specific subjects?
Yes. I would agree with that. And at some stage or another, possibly when I enrolled in a PhD at the ANU and then dropped out, I realised that I had conceived of the studio, my studio, as a laboratory of sorts. It plays out in a very, I suppose, prosaic way. When you think about still life, you set up a still life and then you conduct a controlled experiment.
Yeah.
On the one hand, but I think in a much broader way, I'm not conducting the still life. I'm not conducting the painting experiment on still life. I'm conducting the experiment on me.
Well, but it also feels like you're on a mission to understand the properties of light as well.
I don't want to sound dramatic, but I think it's more connected to the to consciousness. Light helps. Light's always useful for seeing things. But I'm kind of, it struck me not so long ago that I paint because I don't believe my eyes.
Mm.
That's essentially, I don't trust what I see.
You've talked about painting being abstract for you as much as it is figurative, but the abstract, you know, abstract painting doesn't trade in light as a currency like you do. So is the process of painting for you the abstract, not necessarily the outcome, which is clearly figurative?
I think all these terms, abstract, figurative, tend to be more confusing than enlightening. and part of that is because I conceive of all painting as being abstract.
Hmm.
It is abstract.
So an exploration of self in that sense?
No. I think it's more a question of the terminology, as I said before, the terminology gets in the way, and abstraction with a capital A is something abstraction with a capital A is a tradition. It is now a tradition of painting, and it, as with all traditions, it has, it, you know, you can then refer to it. Figuration is also a tradition. It's, you know, there's a dance of the capitals and the lowercase, you know, realism with a capital R and small r realism, which is something else again. And which is something that I do identify with, not so much the capital R realism, but I'm quite attracted to the idea of the ordinary as being not what you think it is. I can remember when I was studying, to go back to the beginning, I guess, I did a component of philosophy at Sydney University while I was studying fine arts, and the course that took my interest was one called The History and Philosophy of Science. And I can remember just being, just stopping in my tracks when the phrase, the theory ladenness of observation, when I came across that phrase, it completely stopped me in my tracks, because I knew exactly I recognised what that was from my own experience of learning to draw, in particular learning to draw, but also learning to paint. Anyone who's tried to draw knows that what you draw is what you see is what you expect to see. And that's the big problem with foreshortening. You know, we always know that something's long and we don't make we don't make allowances for foreshortening. I think that just it affected me so deeply, because one of the other aspects of philosophy that has had an enormous effect on me are the writings of Maurice Merleau-Ponty that I referred to before. And once I got past his writing on art, and his thinking was very much influenced by artists that he knew, his later writings really are very complex, and I don't pretend to understand them in toto at all, nothing like. But this challenge to Cartesian dualism is really interesting, because in some ways it sits in contradistinction to the whole idea of being a figurative painter. I'm here, it's over there, and that's what I'm drawing or painting. And that's the subject-object, it's called the Cartesian split. But that's not the reality of it.
Or does that leave you chasing, or does that leave you in pursuit of trying to render the perfect balance between illusion and physical object?
That's the way I've come to terms with expressing it. It feels to me that painting offers a way of recognizing some aspect of vision experienced, which pushes the limits a little, only a little. I'm not interested in surrealism. I'm interested in pushing the pushing back against the assumptions that govern our normal visual experience. And nothing gives me more pleasure than having someone look at one of my still life paintings in particular, because this is where it goes back to the laboratory. The fact that I can move, and I've written about this frequently, I can move coloured mud around on a piece of stretched fabric, and someone can see something very, quite subtle about something I've seen. It still astonishes me. And when I say something quite subtle, they'll see it, they'll recognise it, but sometimes they don't know quite what they're recognising, and this is where lighting is quite important. And I play in very much in the Mirandian tradition to some degree, because Mirandi was always playing little games with representation, so false attachments and reversals. My project is very different from Mirandi's, but he was such an extraordinarily important artist.
But yours is still very much a study in light.
Yes, I think I'm much more wedded to description, and probably always will be, than someone like Mirandi, who had this extraordinary ability to balance abstract and figurative in his work. I don't think I can go there. I'm too attached to the fascination of what things look like. But you know, it's a direction in which I constantly try and lean.
One of the spaces that feels like you manifest the illusion of painting perfectly are the interiors work, and they feel like such a study of space or light.
Yeah.
Do you mean to make those feel like a dream? Because they feel incredibly ethereal and light. Like they. Do they mean to be quite ethereal?
I think they might reflect some aspect of my own spatial awareness. I tend to need to have not just been in the space, because often they'll be constructed from photographs, but I need to have been in the space and kind of need to have drawn it. Most of the interior, no, I think all actually of the big interiors that I've painted, I've spent quite a lot of time in the space and yeah, needed to have inhabited it and drawn it and yeah.
I think it's interesting you say being in the space because something that's, I think, really interesting about your practice between the interiors and the still life paintings, and we're certainly going to talk about still life, the interior paintings seem like this really sharp contrast to still life, where interiors, as in you've just said, you're inside these containers, and containers being part of your still life study, but you're inside these enormous containers that contain humans, these interior spaces that light's flooding into. In contrast to your still life paintings, where you're looking at containers that, smaller containers that light is bouncing off of. So is, again, is that a deliberate exploration?
Actually, sometimes the still lives feel a little bit like theatre sets. And a lot of the composition in the still lives occurs on the tabletop. So I can spend a ridiculous amount of time moving things around and fiddling with the lighting. So maybe your questions about lighting are more acute than I was prepared to admit, because I wasn't thinking about them in terms of the still life so much. The interiors, the lighting is very important, you're right.
Well, but the light is, you know, the light is pouring into those spaces. And then you play with reflection as well. Seems really important to distort a sense of, well, no, the light pours into those spaces and you end up with a sense of, as a viewer, being able to float through them. They don't feel like as grounded as the still lifes are sitting on a tabletop.
True. And probably a little bit more open to, not narrative, but the significance of the choice of the spaces for the of the interiors. For instance, the interior that that is hanging in the Sydney Modern, or whatever they're calling that building now, the North building at the Art Gallery of New South Wales is a large light-filled atrium. I've been spending a lot of time in Paris and London and around looking for interiors, and it very much had come out of the first ones that I made, which were of airports and these sort of strange halfway no places.
So actually a couple of interiors for listeners to be able to reference. So interior 278, which is the Munich airport, is an excellent example. And then I think the interior you're talking about that's hanging in Sydney at the moment is interior 370.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because the very first, I think one of the first interiors that I made was of Norman Foster's Terminal 5 in London. And if you look at it, and thinking about that now, it's much more like a still life, because I've got all these sort of signs and posts, and there's components, and it feels like it could be, it feels more like a still life than the later ones, like Munich, which was much more of an open kind of transparencies. It's literally a glass cattle run for people. And there's a particular painting that is at Philip Bacon at the moment, which uses dots at eye level so you won't crash into the glass. But they became really interesting components in that sort of light-filled space. And I moved from those liminal spaces, like airports, and I was thinking of Monet's train station, Saint-Lazare, actually, in Paris. Very famous, sort of lots of steam and trains, and this sort of cavernous interior. And looking at the remaining old Parisian stations, which is, then I found a myself in London, of course, there was Waterloo. And those two big Waterloo interiors were very much about the that cavernousness. And, of course, they're so 19th century. And suddenly climate change was looming in my mind as being... They felt like dark satanic mills, you know, something of the past that we need to get past.
Yeah. They presumably offer a different challenge from still life as well. Like, it must feel like, you know, you've talked about your studio space being something you can control in a laboratory, but it sounds like these, you know, these interior paintings, you're actually out in the wild. So they offer a different challenge for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. yes, they're like a wilderness. That's about as close as I'll get to a wilderness.
Well, that's what I mean. You kind of extract yourself out of the laboratory of your lab into these enormous, you know, commercial spaces that you're painting.
They're still contained. I remember having a discussion with my still rather new husband, and we ended up in Christchurch. Mm. And one of the first things we did was drive down to Cromwell. He was telling me about the flooding of the valleys. Mm. And it's I think after England or after London, it was so empty and kind of beautiful and wild. And we're talking about Thomas Hardy and Egdon Heath and how the landscape is given a personality in Hardy's writing. And I suddenly found myself saying to Chris, if you left me sitting on a rock on the edge of the Cromwell, the Clutha, on the edge of the Clutha, and drove off, leaving me sitting on a rock in the edge of the Clutha, I would cease to, after a certain amount of time, I would cease to exist, because I feel like my sense of self is so...
dissipates tenuous into the landscape.
Yeah, but that's why I need boundaries, the interior boundaries of the studio or of the large light-filled space. I fear disintegration. It's a very close. It probably has a lot to do with the difficulties I had in my late teenage, early 20s, where my sense of identity was pretty. It's still pretty, you know.
Well, that's a perfect transition to my next question, which was going to be about still life, which make up, I don't know, you know, certainly the majority of your practice. So, and why they appeal so much, but it's for that reason. They offer some containment and structure for you.
Yeah, limits. One of the discussions that emerged from or as part of post-structuralism was that the illusory nature of our subjectivity, you know, our sense of self is... manifestly, I think it's accepted that it's much less fixed than was previously thought to be, and that was no news to me. I did not have a secure sense of self. I didn't grow up with that.
Is that why there's such a soft surface applied to your subjects in still life scene? Is that a reflection of that? No light pun intended.
I would put it differently. I would say that that my need for a number of things, that my need for a quiet, contained space to work in, my need for... a connection to a figurative tradition, and my attachment to a realist form of painting have everything to do with the fact that I don't feel that security. And there's something... having a stable environment allows me to explore that questioning, explore the uncertainty that I think underlies all the certainty of vision. And it's vision complicated by touch and all sorts of other aspects of our sensorium, which we conveniently put down to five or perhaps six senses, but which I think is a lot more complicated. Our existence in the world is a lot more complicated than we, I think, we'll even admit to ourselves.
Mm.
And so I feel like it sounds like I'm stating a special case for myself. I think everyone wants to keep reality in check, because it does. It's actually, we all know it's not as stable as we think it is, and that's a lot of what goes into my still life painting.
All of that seems to confirm a suspicion that I have about your work, which is that the subjects are almost an afterthought. They're certainly secondary to, ironically, two or three things that are largely invisible in the paintings. So light, the painter, and the viewer.
Yeah. Well said.
Well, thank you, Jude. But is that what you're pursuing as well? Like the subjects really are secondary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's why I don't name them and why I avoid narrative. Absolutely. Because it's much more important for me to keep that open.
I mean, it's almost a cliche, but you're painting the invisible.
I'd say I'm painting the visible, but I question the visible. I question what we categorise as the visible. So... yeah, it is a terrible contradiction, I know. I am painting in a mode which I hope... I'm painting within a tradition which is all about the character of the visible, but what I'm reaching towards is something beyond it.
Mm.
And I think... The best painting, all the best painting does that. Painting in particular, I don't know what it is about painting, but it's terribly special. It's also very hard to find your place as a painter, I think. Perhaps not as hard as it was in the mid-80s, but it's one of the things that, and again, it happened in New Zealand. This is another important, it was terribly formative. Those 10 years in New Zealand were intensely formative for me.
Mm.
I was in my favourite place, possibly in the whole world, certainly in one of my favourite places, in Dunedin. I was in the Co-op bookshop and I picked up a copy of a book called Painting as Model by Yves Alain Bois, who's a very famous theorist and curator. And it's a very interesting book, series of essays. But the thing that really impressed me at the time was the introduction and that's kind of an epilogue at the end of the book, where he talks about the territory. And he's talking about territory of theory, in fact, but somehow I made the small jump for myself of realising that art practice and specifically painting, if you saw it as a territory, just evenly marked out, and tried to find your place in it, it made such a lot of sense. The other thing that made sense for me in his discussions was one towards the end, where he's referring to one of his mentors, his teacher. And the analogy with tennis came up, And I think Judy Miller talked about this, and I didn't. She doesn't. It's not clear in the podcast, but I just went, "Oh, Carmilla, yeah." So Yves Alain Bois saying, you know, it's like painting is like tennis. You don't say it's over just because the game's finished. And I go, oh, it's really interesting, and that sort of iterative. Practice,
yeah.
Where it can be it can be repeated, it can be reinvented to some degree, but it can't be reinvented as tennis unless it refers to its, you know, its roots, its old, its past. So that sort of puts it in perspective, I think.
Well, that's probably not a bad transition to talking about process. So I'm curious to know where a painting starts for you.
When I said before, a lot of work happens moving things around on the tabletop. That's often a place where it starts. And in fact, at some point or another, over the last, I don't know, decade, I suddenly realised that I just go straight into a painting after spending a ridiculous amount of time moving things around on the tabletop. And then when the painting begins, there's another set of moments where usually what I have to do is take something out of the painting, and which means removal from the table as well.
So you keep playing with that composition, both within the work and the setup of the work, the arrangement of subjects.
Yes, and it's kind of a sliding scale, which is a sort of a metaphor I use for a lot of things, so it's probably a bit limited. But Justin Payton once said, coming into my studio and looking at the things on the tabletop, it looked like actors without their makeup on, you know. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I go into the studio and I know when a painting is starting to work, when the painting looks more interesting than the objects on the table. One of the fundamental aspects of my practice for me is not to get... That I tend to get very attracted by description, by, you know, just what something looks like. And essentially what that means is that you forget your painting. And this is a common problem I see in representational painters the world over. It's very easy to become completely seduced by the idea of depiction and description, and in doing so to forget about the painting.
Well, this leads perfectly to another quote of yours that I wanted to throw at you, because it's one of my favourite things I think you've written about your painting. And that is, the way a painting looks does not necessarily reflect the affective and cognitive conditions of its making. So apart from that being a very polite euphemism for how bloody hard painting is, presumably that quote is also about you wanting to make the difficult appear effortless, or wanting to make the difficult appear different, at least.
Oh, this is where one moves immediately to the quotation from Matisse that I think is in Hilary Sperling's biography, possibly the first one, where he describes making a painting as being like a drunk kicking a door down.
I didn't know that. That's great.
So expressive, and the quote that you mentioned there is my very polite version of that, and that in turn came out of more than once people coming up to me at openings or wherever and going, oh, you must be such a calm person.
Well, are you not?
Paint what you need.
Yeah.
And I've referred to it often, you know, there's a sort of low key perpetual disturbance in the process of painting.
Well, that quote goes on to say, The internal processes required involve a rigor and persistence that is not necessarily peaceful. So the words that jump out at me from that quote are rigor and persistence. And I'm wondering how much of a painting for you has nothing to do with material or brush or support. So as a intellectual challenge.
I think they're pretty evenly balanced for me. Sometimes I think that I'm a little plodding in my attempts to manifest the struggle between illusion and materiality, or the subject-object issue in painting. If I was a little more relaxed, I'd probably not bang on about that quite so much. But on the other hand, I get a certain amount of pleasure constructing it in that way.
I'm curious to know about how you manage colour with light. So where does colour fit into the practice?
I'm getting more and more interested in colour. I think I found my way through touch fairly quickly. And yet that continues, and I think it takes a trajectory of integrating it more and more, integrating support and underpainting and the application of paint and the removal of paint, which is at least as important as the putting on of it. So that dimension of touch in painting is primary, or has been primary, but I'm starting to get increasingly interested in coming from a tonal painting background, increasingly interested in colour, and that old chestnut, or is it acorn, relationship between tone and colour in painting is, of course, one of the primary motive forces in early 20th century painting, or late 19th, early 20th century painting.
Presumably there's some creative license you take with colour and subject.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. They kind of look real, I guess, but there's a lot of moving around and modification. And for instance, it's a painting, so you're not going to get the intensity of colour, and you're not going to get the intensity that your eyes give you. Even a photograph won't give you the intensity of an experienced colour. And the relative, you know, the old Matisse quote of, you know, this much blue is a different colour from this much blue.
Yeah.
It's very sort of real. But I did start at some stage or another I realised that you couldn't make just a flat red. It had to be a variety of different reds.
Especially for you to be able to manage light the way you want to with colour.
Well, where's the difference? You know, light's necessary for colour, I suppose. The light thing is interesting in the still lives because you can create different sort of ambiences with different kinds of lighting, and it's extraordinary. I guess it's understandable that people aren't really aware of how I will, for instance, make two paintings of roughly the same objects. With different lighting, and people will know that there's a difference there but not really quite be able to put their finger on what it is, and often they'll alight on colour maybe being different, but
well, because colour is so often the first thing that people see in a painting, obviously.
Yeah The thing about painting, seeing a painting, is that it is and it isn't, you know. It's both an image and an illusion, and it's this sort of material presence that is, no matter how finely painted it is, it's still a material presence.
The way that you manage underpainting seems to acknowledge that. So you allow some of the ground or underpainting to appear in the work itself, as an acknowledgement that it is part illusion or acknowledgement that it is not illusion?
Oh, it's more than one thing. The challenge of being able to retain a certain amount of underpainting is not a slight one, especially if you're if you're a painter who's trying to sort of capture like rotundity or, you know, some effect of three dimensionality in painting, and you have to sort of keep trying to build it up, you're going to lose your underpainting. So there's a challenge in retaining some of that, and underpainting also complicates colour in interesting ways, and the ground or support definitely has an effect on that. So the rougher the weave of the linen you're using, and linen's so much more interesting because it's got unevennesses, that will give you more scope for, you know, that sort of articulation.
Because you prefer quite a coarse linen. Like looking at work in the gallery today, especially some larger works, it's a really coarse linen to the point of it almost looking like canvas. So you prefer that lumpier linen.
Well, it just sort of depends. I think I went through a process of favouring that because it gave me these sort of opportunities, but it also breaks the image up and requires a lot more paint, and so it pushes you into other areas, which is kind of interesting. But the paintings that I'm showing at Two Rooms, this show, they're on a finer grade linen, and that has a lot to do with the scale of their smaller scale paintings as well. So yeah, it's sort of like swings and roundabouts, and bigger paintings you can use a coarser linen and it will do different things to a small painting with coarse linen, which is kind of interesting as well, because it particularly with a small painting, it will fragment it very easily, and that's kind of interesting to have it fragment and hold together at the same time.
You choose to paint in weather oils, you choose to paint with oil paint.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm wondering if there are different dilutions you apply to oil paint to create different levels of fluidity.
Yes, although I keep it all very simple. Mm. And I don't tend to use anything but a very simple mix of stand oil and a solvent, an odorless solvent, in various quantities with the oil paint, depending on what I'm doing. I as part of my articulation of process, which is tied up with revealing the making of the painting, I've watered, or no, actually, not so much watered it down, but I've incorporated various removals, and for that I need to use more solvent. But I've made the decision in those cases to kind of leave the traces of the removal there, so you'll find dribbles going down a painting that I just leave, and often they're left across areas of underpainting. And I use an underpainting, I'm a bit over-attached to using an underpainting of a sort of transparent red oxide, which I keep on sort of thinking, oh, I must break myself of that habit, but it's very useful.
If it ain't broke.
Yeah, it comes out of a very traditional approach, which is prior to the Impressionist white canvas. It was always to establish a half tone, like a mid tone, where you could tonally work up and down, up to light and down to darks. It's just my way of dealing with it. But it does tend to enhance a generally cool palette, which I suppose I favour, although, again, I kind of play around with different colours of maybe background that require a different underpainting sometimes, a bright green or I don't know. But it's that whole just sort of discussion about removal and leaving the traces and not wanting to cross all the T's and dot the I's, etc. And it's very much about me trying to I suppose it's in the parlance of post-structuralism, it's an element of deconstruction which goes right back to until recently with the larger canvases, which I get made now, I'll stretch it up. But I still hand stretch my own small canvases and I reverse it's a bit sort of labour intensive, but it's important to me I buy primed canvas, reverse it, and then reprime it so that the edges are raw linen. And that's very important to me to make evident that the painting is a sort of skin on top of what you can see at the sides, which is the raw linen. And it's so deeply integrated into my approach to painting now that I kind of can't let it go.
Well, it sounds like you really want the viewer... You talked about revealing process. It sounds like you really want the viewer to be able to see that, like literally see it. Let some of the underpainting appear and...
It enhances the duality of what a painting is, or the dual nature of a painting, I should say, more accurately, which is... the material reality and the processing it too quickly as an image. And the quick processing element of things is just getting faster and faster. And I am all about wanting it to pull it back and slow it down for my own reasons. But I think I actually have this sort of conviction that it's going to get more important. I'm not necessarily delighted by the association, which would be far too easy, or is too far too easy to make with the return to craft and artisan and all that sort of thing. But it's kind of in the territory, and there's a good reason for it. You know, everything is so fast and so in technically superficial. That I feel that there is something potentially quite important to our being human. And don't even get me started about AI. It just,
Well, another interview, maybe. Well, Jude, last question. Removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist would you love to live with?
Okay, can I have two?
You absolutely can have two.
So the Cézanne at the Courtauld Institute is dated 1905. He died in 1906. It's one of the last paintings he made, and it was included in the famously unfinished Cézanne show. And it does have a lot of subtly tinted cream-coloured canvas. But I happened on the sesquicentenary exhibition that the Courtauld had amassed of all their Cézannes in a little square room, and I walked in and it was by itself near the door, and it just radiates. Oh, conviction and lightness, and it's such an extraordinary piece of work. But the other painting that I would have probably in the same room is the Mirandi that Margaret Olley donated to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. It's painted around the time that I was born, and it's my favourite sort of period of Mirandi. It's sort of towards the end of his life. It's 1956-57, and it's the most splendid little painting, and all his little tricks are there. The false attachment of an object and a bright orange that's stuck behind something but leaps forward, and you know, it's the perfect Mirandi, really. I'd have those two, thanks. Can you arrange it, perhaps?
I'll see what I can do.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Your next chance to see new work from Jude is until the 30th of September at Two Rooms Gallery in Auckland. Or contact Two Rooms Gallery for available work. Please join me for episode 14 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.